Space Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Last Night in Soho, Antlers, The French Dispatch, Army of Thieves, and Hypnotic. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Blu-rays of Don't Breathe 2 and The Suicide Squad. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece is about Dune, which had a pretty good weekend last week with $41 million it made over the weekend. And honestly, that's the best that Warner Brothers has done on their hybrid releases. $41 million, I mean, that's not any record-breaking thing, but that's a good number. And it does kind of bust that whole day-and-date kills theatrical releases narrative, though. Same thing as how Halloween Kills a couple weeks ago made a lot of money, almost $50 million, and that kind of killed the whole idea that having it on a streaming service kills it because, oh my gosh, the boogeyman of piracy. Notice how we're not hearing anybody complaining about any piracy going on with Halloween Kills or Dune, even though it's a pristine version of the movie that's available on your home cinema. Now, that caused them to greenlight a sequel, but what's weird about it, they didn't greenlight the sequel until a couple days into the week. Usually, if it's a good number, if it made like $41 million on Saturday, they would have greenlit that before the end of the weekend. But the fact that they took some time, I think, meant that there was some backdoor wrangling between Legendary Pictures and Warner Brothers and about budgets and contracts and what kind of release would it get. I guarantee you, Denis Villeneuve was saying, oh, now it must have an exclusive theatrical release. And I wouldn't be surprised if Warner Brother wanted to put some sort of HBO Max deal, maybe not release part two on HBO Max in 2 years, because that's how long it's going to take to get that movie done, but to maybe after the movie's released and it comes out on home video, to then promote like an 8-episode miniseries version of the movie and put that on HBO Max, and I'm sure that was kind of part of the negotiation, because I think that that's where Dune actually would work better story-wise. Now, farther down the line was Halloween Kills making $14.5 million, which is a huge drop. That's 70% from what it made last weekend. But this movie is still going to generate heat this weekend. It's certainly going to have less of a drop this weekend. It's not going to go down 70%. But because it's Halloween weekend, I imagine you might even see a little bit of a bump. Who knows? It might do even better this weekend because of the advantage of Halloween and, of course, people watching it at home. And then Ron's Gone Wrong made a miserable $7.3 million, and that's mainly because it just got no support from the studio. They just dropped it out there and let it go. But the big movie news that is seeming to dominate the regular news cycle is this business with Alec Baldwin on the set of Rust accidentally shooting the cinematographer and the director getting winged as well. And I've heard the Monday morning quarterback saying, well, you know, the first rule of gun safety is you always check the breech. You always open the gun when you hand it to somebody. Look, that's not the way it works on a movie set. And people are saying, should we charge him with any sort of criminal event? No, you shouldn't. He was doing nothing wrong. He was doing exactly what an actor does. And if you're saying that it's up to the actor when he's given a gun on set that may be a prop and may not be a prop, may be a real gun, may not even have a mechanism in it, that it's up to him, he's the stop. You don't want that in the hands of an actor. An actor has to be focused on his lines and his mark and his acting and his emotional state and making himself look for the camera and know where the camera is. And maybe they're in some sort of makeup or prosthetic, or maybe they have gloves on their hands. There's a billion different things that will distract an actor, and we would be distracted looking at it, but you can't have an actor open up a firearm and examine the cartridges in it. That's why you have a props department. That's why you have an armorer. There's an investigation going on by the sheriff. The insurance company is going to do an investigation. The production's probably doing its own investigation. They're going to find neglect. I mean, the assistant director handed him the gun and said cold gun or something like that, according to affidavits. there have been statements that the armor in the past had you know, cut some corners and had some problems before. There's things happening with the crew and being overworked and some people leaving set because of safety issues. That stuff's all going to be coming out, but that right now that's all just like rumor and speculation. But at some point they're going to find neglect. And if it's criminal neglect, they're not going to, it's not something they're going to have to go after Alec Baldwin unless they go after him as a producer on it. And at that point, then you could go after the armor and the art department and the props department and the assistant director and the power structure. I think really what's going to end up happening is this is just going to tighten up some regulations, some firearm regulations in the movie industry. And here's the thing. This is a rare instance. This is not something that happens very often. The last time there was something especially this high profile and this devastating was the death of Brandon Lee, which was like 30 years ago. And not at all to minimize anything going on here, but think of the hundreds of, if not thousands of movies and individual television episodes that are made with guns in the production somehow. How many armors are on set and working with guns? I mean, when I'm not just talking about a Michael Bay movie or a John Wick film, I'm talking about just everyday cop shows. Brooklyn Nine-Nine has firearms in it. And this is a huge rarity, and as awful as it is, and I think it will need to cause some of the treatment and the day-to-day safety and some of the protocols to be updated and more stringent, and I think oversight from the unions involved, not just the production union, but, you know, cinematographers union. Somebody got killed for the DGA, Screen Actors Guild. All those people are going to require higher safety, but this is very rare. So this is actually a testament to how relatively safe guns are on sets and how they are done right. And they're already finding cracks in the armor, no pun intended, showing certain neglectful movements here. But ultimately, you know, what happened to Alec Baldwin, I don't care what you think of Alec Baldwin personally or politically or whatever. If you're there making fun of him, you're a horrible person. You are a bad person. This is the equivalent of going to work and having something happen that is not your fault and it results in the death of somebody, but it's somehow tied to you. It was not his fault as an actor. He was an innocent bystander in this whole thing, and shame on you if you're out there making fun of him, because this is human life involved here, and it's not just politics. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is the movie Ambulance, which is coming to theaters on February 18th.
My wife needs this surgery. This is real life.
How's that right? You put your life down on the line for this country? You leave your family, your home? How much do you need?
231.
How about more? 32 million. I need an extra man.
I came to you for a loan.
Look, have I ever gotten you anything that I couldn't get you out of?
It's time for you to do something for your family.
Go, 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 go!
Lock everything down. Nothing gets out.
This is a Michael Bay movie, and as we all know, Michael Bay movies are explosive and loud and are the giant beer commercial. And that's exactly what this looks like. I don't know. Is there a story? Is there a plot? Is there character development? Just a big, giant, explosive Michael Bay movie where everybody, it looks absurdly attractive in there. I don't know how this guy ever came out of the Me Too movement unscathed. Let's talk about the next one, which is Lightyear, which is coming out on June 17th.
Go, Fido. Go. Guide. Go, Fido.
Cabin pressurization is underway.
As we prepare for ignition. Flight recorders are on. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Infinity.
And
this is the movie about Buzz Lightyear, and it's about the character of Buzz Lightyear. I'm not exactly sure. As I understand it, it is the story of Buzz Lightyear, the character that Andy watches in Toy Story is based on, and thus they have the toys from this. So there's a whole bunch of different levels to this, but honestly, this just looks like a nice science fiction adventure. I'm looking forward to this. They don't give much of a story here. It's a pretty thin trailer that's just mostly imagery, but it looks cool, and I'm looking forward to this one. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Hypnotic and Army of Thieves. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Hypnotic. A woman psychiatrist hypnotizes her, and she later discovers she may have been given dangerous suggestions while she was under.
I have general anxiety, so sometimes it's hard to feel motivated. I think you should see Dr. Mead. He changed my life.
Have you ever tried hypnosis?
The last I remember was being at home, sitting at the table. But now, I'm having weird dreams.
You're playing someone use hypnosis with ill intent.
Whatever his reason, I don't think he's done with you yet.
This is on Netflix right now. This is actually going to be the Netflix segment because this one and the next movie are both on Netflix currently. This is a thriller. It's not really, I wouldn't call this a horror movie. It's more of sort of that dark psychological thriller because, you know, it's limited. There are a lot of people out there, and especially like filmmakers when they talk down about streaming films, but this one looks like it was always going to be a streaming film, always going to be a Netflix film, was not something that was picked up out of the pandemic or anything. And a lot of times you'll see people talk down to those films. They'll be like, oh, they feel like a TV movie. And to be honest, look, I've seen these kind of movies before in theaters. I mean, 10 years ago, you would have totally seen this in a theater. You know, it has a couple somewhat recognizable names, but nothing huge, but it looks good. This is a higher quality. This is sort of like what the standard basic Netflix movie is before you get to the really big stuff that they spend a lot of money on and get a lot of big names. But it does kind of feel higher level, at least than what you had back in the 90s with like direct to cable stuff, like Showtime original movies even. So this one still has a certain degree of development and, you know, a certain degree of quality to it. It is rather simple in its presentation and its scope. It has an interesting cast because Dulé Hill's listed pretty high up in there, but he doesn't show up until later. And he's okay. And I just can't, it's impossible for me to watch this movie without thinking of him as Burton Guster. But it also has Kate Siegel in this, and she's best known for being in Mike Flanagan's movies, you know, stuff like The Haunting of Hill House, and she was in Hush, Midnight Mass, you know, The Haunting of Bly Manor. So pretty much everything that Mike Flanagan done because they're married. But he's not really attached to this one, so it's odd to see her doing something that Mike Flanagan doesn't have his fingerprints all over. And it's good because I think she actually acts better in this one. I'm not a big fan of her in the other stuff I've seen her in. But she plays the woman who has the hypnosis done on her. And then you have Jason O'Mara, who plays the hypnotist or the psychologist. He is recognizable. He was in that show Life on Mars. It was a remake of a British show. And it was on TV 10 years ago, something like that. This is an okay sort of just a standard psychological thriller. I wish they would have made it take place in the 70s because it really feels like one of those 70s psychological thrillers because it's dealing with sort of that weird pop psychology. I mean, yeah, you still have hypnotherapy that goes on a lot now and it's still considered a legitimate thing, but this would have felt so much more like it fits in that area where it's when psychiatrists and psychologists were trying everything from primal scream therapy to hypnosis. And I like those movies because there's sort of this wild west of burgeoning psychology. And a lot of it was hogwash, but everybody was trying it and it was very trendy then. I felt like this would fit more into that time frame, but you know, that's just me. Still, it's an okay little thriller for just sort of like a 90-minute getaway. So I have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The next movie I want to talk about is also on Netflix, and that is Army of Thieves. Ludwig Dieter, the safecracker from Army of the Dead, is recruited to open a series of impossible safes across Europe.
Ludwig Dieter, we've been watching you, and we want to recruit you. You're familiar with the outbreak in America.
Do I turn people into flesh-eating monsters? Yes, I heard something about it.
The world's distracted. This window of opportunity isn't just our only chance, it's yours.
My only chance for what?
A life less ordinary.
The this is weird because in a way it feels like it's trying to be a Fast and Furious movie that acknowledges the Army of the Dead. The Army of the Dead, that's of course where he's brought in, and there's this zombie apocalypse that has happened, and they've cordoned off the city of Las Vegas, and they have to go in and try and bust money out of a casino basement or something like that. And this movie has these little ties to it. In the background, you're constantly seeing like references to this zombie apocalypse starting on the news and interviews with people. And every now and then they mention a character, like they mention the old Japanese businessman from Army of the Dead at one point in there. But in a lot of ways, it feels like they took Army of the Dead and said, hey, let's spin off this character and do a Fast and Furious movie without all the big fast cars and without the, it's family. It must be family. Family's the, you know, it's focused on the character of Ludwig Dieter, and he's fun in it. I mean, it's one of those movies that, you know, I enjoyed it, but I'm kind of still flummoxed on how it was ever made, because the guy who plays Ludwig is the guy who directs this. I'm not exactly sure how they put this together, but it's a prequel in a way. And I mean, it works. It's fun. It's not as much of a heist movie as like an Ocean's film, but it certainly has that high stakes, high priced prizes that they're going for. And it even has one of the women who's in it, one of the characters played by Natalie Emmanuel. She's in the Fast and Furious movies. You know, this is just a fun kind of throwaway thing. It's one of those, again, like I said, it blows my mind that this thing got made, because it's sort of taking the character was fun in Army of the Dead. And I love the fact that they've kind of wrapped a movie around his character, which was, I would not call it a significant role in that movie, but it's fun. This is a neat little spinoff, and you know, it's a neat little action flick, and I enjoyed it. I'd like to see them do some more of this kind of stuff where they take risks. And that's one of the things, of all the things people talk, and people will badmouth the streaming services, Netflix in particular. But one of the things I think is great is they're taking risks within their system. They're, you know, that's how you get stuff like the Fear Street series. That was really fun to watch, and a great thing to watch now, because it's slasher inspired, and it's Halloween weekend. But that was a cinematic experience and a real experiment in how to present a series of films, and that dropped on Netflix this summer. I also think that doing, when they did like the stuff in Bandersnatch and even that Kimmy Schmidt movie where they had the, you know, choose your path type thing where you have branching technology, but putting together a movie like this is neat. I love the fact that they're making their own spinoffs. I, like I said, I don't know if there was ever a big call for this guy to get his own movie, but it's entirely enjoyable, and it works as a heist movie, and it doesn't overdo it as a heist movie. I think the Fast and Furious movies have gotten absurd over the years, and this is just kind of trying to be another little heist movie. And it serves into this universe, and I think they're going to probably make more characters and more stories and backgrounds of the characters from Army of the Dead. So, you know, why not start with this guy? So I'm going to have to say this kind of rocks. I kind of had fun with it.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Antlers and Last Night in Soho. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some more movies, and this is going to be the more of the horror segment of being Halloween weekend and all. Because the first one I want to talk about is Antlers. In a small Oregon town devastated by the opioid epidemic, a teacher notices a troubled child who has a monstrous secret at home.
What's going on?
We found a part of a man in the woods today.
Part of a man?
I guess the other half was found in the mine. Oh, this has got to be an animal, right?
No animal that I've ever seen.
These drawings belong to a student of mine.
This is what was in the mine. It's a diabolical spirit.
This is produced by Guillermo del Toro. Now, he doesn't direct it, but, you know, his fingerprints are all over it. And look, Guillermo del Toro could do a romantic comedy. He could remake Singing in the Rain, and it would still be like a horror movie. I mean, that's the way Guillermo del Toro is. He has that touch to him. But it's really Scott Cooper's film. He directed movies like, he directed Crazy Heart. That's the one with Jeff Bridges. Over 10 years ago that came out. But then he did the movie Out of the Furnace. And that one is one I would point out even more so than stuff like Black Mass or Hostiles. Out of the Furnace was a movie with Christian Bale, and his character was dealing with meth addiction and the destruction of a community. So you're seeing that happen in this film. It's not about meth and opioids and the destruction of a community that way necessarily, but that pervades the backdrop. That is where you're coming from. And of course, the characters in it and the monsters can be symbolic of that and symbolic of the innate structure of the town being poisoned, so to speak, by the drugs and the usage and that element of the town's lives. The story follows Carrie Russell as the teacher, and she's from that town, and she was abused in the past and has a bad history there, and she had moved away and gone to California to be a teacher. Now she's back because her father had finally passed away. And Jesse Plemons plays her brother, and they live together, and he's the sheriff in town. And so she's just trying to do good, and she's sees this troubled kid in the class, but, you know, they're running up against the wall with a bunch of different things because there's only so many resources in the area to take care of kids and families. And they address that a lot. So, like I said, that the whole idea of a town decimated by drugs and meth and opioids, it's ever present. One of the things that's a problem with this movie for me is it doesn't find a way to ramp up the dread. You know, a good thriller, a good horror movie starts at, you know, zero and goes 0 to 60. You know, it's, and sometimes it goes very fast, but sometimes it takes its time, and a really good one kind of builds and you start getting this dread, and before you know it, you're surrounded. The second the movie starts, it's all dark and creepy and horrible, and everybody's life is terrible. There's nowhere to go. I mean, you're at 11 already with the dread. It reminds me of when they remade Pet Sematary a couple years back, and you go back to the original Pet Sematary, and it's a beautiful house and a beautiful family, and isn't it nice what they can do? But then they find that there's darker things and things in the wood, and there's the ever-present danger of the freeway right next to them, and you know, then you start to realize how dangerous this place is. Whereas if you watch the remake of Pet Sematary, the second they pull up to the house, you're like, that place is terrible. Do not move in. That's a problem with movies nowadays, I notice. Horror movies, they don't build. They start at that level, but they got nowhere to go. So by that time you get to the end, it's not horrifying. It, you know, you're just sort of fatigued by it. You're used to it. And that's one of the stumbling blocks I had with this film, that, you know, eventually you're like, oh, something horrible happened. Well, you know, it's kind of been horrible for the last 45 minutes, so why is this shocking me? But, I mean, it's still effectively done. It has some very creepy scenes. It deals with myths and legends, in particular the myths and legends of the native people in that area. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to engage in spoilers, although I think, you know, I've seen interviews with Guillermo del Toro where he talks about what's really going on. And I'm like, well, that's a little spoilery because you're talking about stuff that's well deep into the second act, maybe even the third act of the film. But it, you know, it has its moments, and it's unnerving and it's unsettling and it's creepy. You know, it's just that even if you can get rid of whatever this horrible thing is going on in these people's lives, they're still living in a terrible city. So you kind of have to shrug at the end and be like, oh, well, I saved you from this, but now you got to deal with all this other crap. But still, I found it an interesting movie. It's worth checking out, especially if you like horror movies. It's the one big bona fide horror movie of the week. And I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Last Night in Soho. Edgar Wright directs this thriller about a girl going to fashion school in London who has visions of the past, revealing a darker underbelly in the town.
What you say?
So what brings you down then?
I'm studying London College of Fashion.
The room is on the top floor.
It's perfect. I love it. If I could live any place in any time, I'd live here in London in the 60s. Last night, I saw something in my dreams. They're not just dreams.
You think you can just walk away?
It really happened.
For those not familiar with Edgar Wright, he is very well known as a high-energy, visual, punchy director. He also is known for his use of music. In particular, Baby Driver, his most recent film, which was like 5 years ago, not including the Sparks Brothers, which also is that's a documentary about musicians. But in Baby Driver, they basically cut that to the soundtrack. It's very integral to the movie. He did, you know, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World Ends. He also did Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So his stuff's very visual and bright and colorful and striking. And you certainly get that color. You don't get a washed out 60s. Those Austin Powers scenes in the Austin Powers movies when they're in the swinging 60s and he's walking around going, yeah, baby. You know, I mean, it's that. It's very colorful. It's very vibrant. And it's about this girl who romanticizes the 60s and the Soho location in London at the time. But it also kind of wags its finger at people who romanticize and have over nostalgia about the past. And I like that because, you know, as opposed to something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I really feel was just Quentin Tarantino building a little sandbox and playing around and going, oh, wasn't it so fun in the 60s in Hollywood? Whereas this one, it's sort of a cautionary tale of saying, hey, what you thought was the greatest time in London's history actually had some really horrible stuff going on. You just choose to ignore it because you're romanticizing it. You know, in a way, like that movie Midnight in Paris that came out 12 or so years ago with Owen Wilson. It was a Woody Allen movie. That wasn't one about romanticizing the past, but it kind of said, hey, everybody always romanticizes the past. And if you go back to that past, the people there romanticized something before. Like people, if you're nostalgic for the 80s, if you were to go back to the 80s, everyone was nostalgic for the 50s back then. So it does have that message in there. Now, it's a visually stunning movie, and it has great use of music, and it has great use of cinematography. It looks fantastic, and it's slick as all get out. But it's also creepy, and it has that English thriller. It's funny, I just recently watched the movie Don't Look Now, which stars Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. And that is a British film. It takes place in Venice, but it's a British film, and it deals with precognition and memory and dread. And it's not an overt in your face horror movie. I actually was reading that Edgar Wright was inspired partly by Don't Look Now. And it makes, because it's funny, because when I saw it, I said, this reminds me a little bit of that movie where you've got somebody chasing something that they don't know what it is. The drawback, though, on this one is Edgar Wright's only done one other horror movie, and that's Shaun of the Dead, and arguably that's kind of part horror, part comedy. This one's straight-up horror movie. I would call it that, psychological horror, for sure. There are times where the movie kind of overstays its welcome. In the hands of a more seasoned horror director, I think they would have, you know, tightened up the scenes a little bit, because at a certain point, I was getting tired of figuring everything out before the main character did. There's not a whole lot of surprises, and even the surprises, I kind of guessed from the beginning, but, you know, it's nice to watch it play out. So I would have liked to have seen what Edgar Wright would do with this movie were he more adept at doing horror, but it's still a worthwhile see. It's still a really good movie and creepy and worth checking out on Halloween weekend, that's for sure. So I'm going to say that this one kind of rocks as well.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The French Dispatch and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Don't Breathe 2 and The Suicide Squad. Downtown, just listen to the music. Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock. Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the new one that's out this week, and that is The French Dispatch. This was out in limited release this past week, and it's finally opening wide this week. Wes Anderson's latest film is an anthology of stories from a fictional French insert to a Kansas newspaper on the eve of its cancellation in the 1970s.
It began as a holiday. Eager to escape a bright future on the Great Plains, Arthur Howitzer Jr. transformed the series of travelogue columns into the French Dispatch, a factual weekly report on the subjects of world politics, the arts, high and low, and diverse stories of human interest.
You don't think it's almost too seedy this time?
No, I don't.
For decent people. It's
supposed to be charming.
I'm going to just go right out of the gate and tell people I am a huge Wes Anderson fan. There are some I like better than others, and I would say his weakest movies for me, Bottle Rockets, because he's unrefined at that point. It's interesting to see where he's coming from, but you know, Bottle Rockets a little unrefined. I am not a fan of Rushmore. I can appreciate it now, but I did not fall in love with Rushmore. I fell in love with the Royal Tenenbaums. And ever since Royal Tenenbaums, he's had his ups and downs. I mean, the Darjeeling Limited, it has its moments, but it's not a great movie. But I've loved a lot of what he's done, you know, even his more recent stuff, including his animated stuff like, you know, Fantastic Mr. Fox, I think was great. I thought Isle of Dogs was wonderful. And he was really experimenting and figuring out where he wanted to be in terms of movies. So I was really interested to see what he was going to do with The French Dispatch, because I know it was, again, a diversion for him because it's an anthology and he hasn't done that yet. It's so hard because I saw this movie once, and I'm sure if I go back and watch it again, a couple times, and I may try and watch it again during award season, especially if it starts picking up some big award nominations, I will probably like it more. Because I remember when I saw The Life Aquatic, I was a little bit sour on that one because I thought it mimicked Royal Tenenbaums too much. And since then, I've really come to enjoy The Life Aquatic. But, you know, stuff like Moonrise Kingdom, I thought was so different than the other stuff he's done, but it still touched your heart. This one, it's almost like he wanted to become even quirkier than he already is. It's almost that he became self-aware of his quirks. And you know that he's aware of how quirky his style is and how stylized he makes his movies. But this one just, it felt like he leaned into it too much. Part of the problem is he seemed to trade the story away for quirkiness. And there are some certain stories that are better than others. Like the one that has, it has Frances McDormand and Timothée Chalamet in it. And I know I'm getting down on Timothée Chalamet. I think I don't want to sound hyperbolic, but he is the most overrated actor on the planet. I don't think he's that great at all. I am not a Chalamaniac. Let's just put it that way. This one just seemed to be overly pretentious because it does seem to lean into the French New Wave snobbery that I guess you could say. And I guess that's kind of the point of this one particular story, that Frances McDormand plays an older woman who is having to interact with these young French students during, you know, sort of revolutionary times. But it does get a little bit, you know, overwrought with that. And there's some better pieces and some real interesting stuff that he tries, but I never felt that there was a holistic story. I think by telling the shorter stories, he squandered some of the better characters. But it's still a neat movie. Especially if you like Wes Anderson movies, it's certainly Wes Anderson doing a Wes Anderson movie, even if he's a little bit too aware of doing that. So French Dispatch, you know, it's still good. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks, but it's certainly not my favorite of his.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first movie I want to talk about is Don't Breathe 2, which is available on DVD and Blu-ray this week. Stephen Lang returns as a blind veteran who is trying to protect his daughter from a home invasion.
What do you want?
You're coming with us, kid.
Get the girl!
It's not me you need to be scared of, little girl. But the man standing next to you. Now, I don't know who he is, but I know who he's not. Should I tell her or you?
He's gonna come for me.
Now, you're gonna see what I see.
Now, if you've seen the first Don't Breathe, you'll know that his character's not the good guy in that one. He's a bad guy. He's a very bad guy. But they do play around with it in the sense that he's doing these horrible things, and I wouldn't say he's doing them for the right reasons. But he's not doing them for evil reasons, necessarily. He is using evil methods and he's doing bad things. But he's trying to fill something that was unjustly taken from him. Does not excuse what he does in that movie. But he was so good in that film. And Stephen Lang is such a powerful actor. And he is so formidable and creepy and strong, not just physically, but his presence is great. In this movie, they make him a much more sympathetic character. He's the good guy. He's trying to protect this kid who ostensibly is his daughter. Of course, we find out a little bit more about it when the home invasion comes in. And he's this force of nature that goes after people and does not take no from the reason. Most importantly, he doesn't take no from the universe. He just makes it happen. And this has, this is a very dark movie because the characters are very dark. And like I said, it's unpleasant people. There is this element that there's really no good guy in there. There's some depth to his character where he is acknowledging the sins of his past and salvage the relationship that he has. This is effectively done. It's got a very dark palette. But that's because his character is blind. It's also neat that this comes with a voice description for the blind who can watch this movie, which I think is certainly a nice gesture for a character that's blind. Not loaded with special features. It's got like three featurettes and it's got like an extended ending that's a minute long. And so it's not extended by much. But I have to say, I really enjoyed this one. I liked what it did and how it took what was happening in Don't Breathe and took it farther. So I was pleasantly surprised with the unnerving nature of this film. So I'm going to have to say Don't Breathe 2 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the home cinema roundup and talk about the Suicide Squad, which has finally hit Blu-ray. A ragtag team of DC supervillains are recruited by the U.S. government to stop an international menace.
Each member is chosen for his or her own completely unique set of abilities. Your mission is to destroy every trace of something known only as Project Starfish.
This is suicide.
Oh, that's kind of our thing.
I'm a superhero!
Ratatouille, what do you got?
Bird.
Now it. Stay off the comm.
I know if you've heard me talk about Suicide Squad several months ago when it came out, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it when I first saw it. I watched it a couple times on HBO Max, and I just love this movie. This is such a absurd, over-the-top, fun, stupid movie. It is not meant to be a moralistic journey, but it has this weird moral compass to it. And that's all because of James Gunn. And it's such a shame that this movie did not perform better. And I'm not even just saying, I think regardless of HBO Max, it would have underperformed because it certainly was not going to make $300 million like the first movie. And that first Suicide Squad was absolute garbage. This one's so much more fun. It has the characters and they're weird and they're strange. And it's got some great actors. John Cena and Idris Elba balance the movie itself with humor. And there's actually a real soul there that Idris Elba has, and even somebody like Joel Kinnerman, who plays Flag in this one, he was in the last movie. This one, he's a better character. He's so much more fleshed out. And the other thing about this is, if you're going to get the Blu-ray, it's loaded with special features. There's a ton of special features in it. They got a gag reel and deleted and extended scenes. More importantly, they got a ton of behind-the-scenes making of that goes into the special effects and, you know, how they made people look the way they did and how they designed different people's costumes and pulling them out of the comic book and making them looking real. And, you know, it also has a whole bunch of scenes that they break down and give you the background of it. And it's a fascinating look at this because it's got James Gunn and it's got his energy behind it. And it's got him kind of just like a kid explaining all the cool stuff that he did. But it also shows some really interesting elements of filmmaking and what is real caught in camera and what isn't. And how you take some of these characters that are so bizarre, like Polka Dot Man and King Shark, and make them some of the most endearing, lovable characters I've seen on a screen this year. So there's a lot of magic to this movie, and I honestly believe that this movie is going to be remembered much more fondly than the first piece of garbage that came out. Yeah, The Suicide Squad is a lot of fun. It's great. Check it out. If you don't have it on DVD or Blu-ray, get it because it's worth having just in case. So I'm going to say this one totally rocks as well.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available, there's vintage releases of Deep Red from Dario Argento. Uncut Gems is getting a Criterion release. And then new releases on Blu-ray of Blood for Dracula, Nothing But Trouble, and the notorious movies about Fritz the Cat. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Eternals and Finch. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.